أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم، بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم، والصلاة والسلام على خير المرسلين وعلى آله وأصحابه أجمعين، ولا حول ولا قوة إلا بالله العلي العظيم. سبحانك اللهم لا علم لنا إلا ما علمتنا إنك أنت العليم الحكيم. So we're continuing with the Risala of Ibn Abi Zayd al-Qayrawani. We've done five lessons so far, and those first five lessons encompass the entirety of Aqidah. Basically, we had the introduction, and then the first four classes dealt with the book that relates to Aqidah. Moving on, we are now about to begin the section that deals with fiqh, with the science of actions, which the branches of knowledge, with the things that you are required to do. And the most important of these, aside from the shahada, which is the key for Aqidah, the most important of the actions that we do as a Muslim is
Right.
Salah, the prayer. But for the prayer to be valid, certain things are required that have to be put in place first. There's an important principle that if something is obligatory, the things that have to be in place for that thing to be done are also obligatory. So the most important of those is tahara, purification, or being in a state of purity. And so that is where traditionally all of the people of knowledge begin their books of fiqh, in the section that deals with tahara. Now, there are certain different ways in which people begin this. Sometimes they go straight back to the asl, which is the instrument of purity, which is water. So they'll start with water because you can't have purification without it. And they will start by going into all of the qualities that water has to have. That's what we happened in that class that we were in last week in Morocco. The other, so then you go through, you have the water, and then you then have the explanation of how you go about doing wudu with this water. Because wudu is, there's two types of purification in terms of, there's one that removes the lesser state of impurity, and there's one that removes the greater state of impurity. But the one that you have to do more often is wudu. So they generally start with wudu because it's one that we have to be more familiar with because we do it much more frequently. The other side that they do is they start by describing when wudu becomes obligatory on a person. So we know in which state we have to be in order for us to do wudu. And that's what he does here. So the first thing he mentions are the things that make it necessary or obligatory for you to do wudu. The things that remove your wudu. If you want to pray, which states are you in? Which things do you do that take you in a state where it's not fit for you to pray, so that you are required to put in place that precondition for prayer, which is wudu. So that's how he starts here. So he says, "Babu ma yajibu minhu al-wudu wal-ghusl wal-ghasl." There's two languages in this, two ways of saying it. They both mean basically the same thing. So I mean, some people say that the technical description of the type of cleansing that we do, the Taharat al-Kubra, is called ghusl. Some people say it's called ghasl. It doesn't make that much of a difference. Some people say ghasl is simply the act of washing oneself. Some people say ghusl is simply the act of washing oneself, and ghasl is the name, so it doesn't make any difference. The only one that's completely different, because they have lots of Arabic words that have three, ghusl, ghasl, ghisl, fu'l, fa'al, fi'l. Ghisl is the one that's different here, which means a type of soap, the thing that you use for washing yourself. So chapter or section or book, literally a door of what makes wudu and ghusl obligatory from it. That's literally what it says here. So we're going into what's known in other books as the nawaqid al-wudu, the things that break wudu, and the nawaqid al-ghusl are the things that break your state of ghusl. So he says this, then he says that firstly, the mujibat al-wudu, the things that make wudu obligatory. And Ibn Ashir numbers these at 16, 16 different things that make wudu obligatory. He's going to go through these in two different sections. The first section deals with what's called the ahdath, and they are things that come out of the body that themselves render your wudu broken. And then you have what's called asbab, the reasons, and they are things that come over you that do not come out of the body, but cause things to probably come out of the body. you're not aware of your state when those things have happened to you. An example might be sleep, which is known as the lesser death. What happens when a lot of people, if you've gone to a janazah, or you'll know what happens after a body has died. The person no longer has control over their orifices. So you have to do it for them. You have to push out, when you're doing a ghusl for a body, you have to push out all of the impurities yourself because they just come out. The same thing happens with sleep to a lesser extent. You no longer have control over your body's orifices. Not necessarily urine and feces, but definitely with wind. Wind just comes out without you being able to be aware of it or stop it.
Not 1 hour, 2 hours, not. You have to make wudu again.
Depends how deep we're going to come to that when we come to depends how deep it is. There are also two things that he doesn't mention here, which do break wudu, and they are ridda, leaving the deen, making a conscious decision that you're no longer Muslim. This doesn't mean somebody's going along and they're studying something in the deen and suddenly doubts come over them about the veracity of what they're studying or whatever it is, or suddenly they have a doubt. That doesn't do anything. That does not mean you've stopped becoming a Muslim, that you have to do wudu. But if you say, right, that's it, I'm making a conscious decision with this, may Allah protect us all from that. If you take a conscious decision of leaving the deen, that makes wudu obligatory for you. If you come back to the deen after making that conscious decision, obviously. So you might ask, well, then why, when somebody makes the shahada, are they told they have to make a ghusl? Surely leaving the deen makes the ghusl obligatory, you would probably think from that. But no, the reason for that is because when somebody comes into the deen for the first time, they are undoubtedly in the state of impurity because they are adult. They are adult, and so they have reached puberty, which involves a wet dream or involves menstruating, which are both things that place you in a state of impurity. So that's the vast likelihood. So, okay, occasionally somebody might reach puberty without having a wet dream, but that's for a man, but that's a rarity. So that the assumption is that every non-Muslim is in a state of impurity. That's one of the reasons why it says that non-Muslims are not allowed to come into mosques, according to the position of Malik. Obviously, the ayat talks about the Masjid al-Haram, but Imam Malik expanded it on the basis because it said that they were najasun, that they were impure. Why are non-Muslims considered to be impure? The same reason Muslims are considered to be impure, because they're in a state of janabah or a state of having menstruated. And Muslim who is in a state of janabah is not allowed to come into the mosque. A woman who is menstruating cannot come into the mosque for the same reason. So that's the first one. The second one is what's called shak, doubt. So there's different types of, and this is not talking about doubt being a Muslim. This is talking about doubt of whether you're in wudu or not, or doubt whether you're in a state of purity or not. So there's different types of doubt, and there are different times when it can come. If you experience a doubt as to whether you have done wudu or not, you can't remember having done wudu, or whether you've broke, you can remember doing wudu, but you can't remember if you've broken it or not, and that happens outside of the prayer, then your wudu is broken and you have to go, both cases, and you have to go and do wudu. That doubt is enough to, doubt meaning not being certain here. We're not talking about doubt in the sense of 50-50. It means you're not certain that you are in wudu. If it's outside the prayer, that's enough to render your wudu invalid and you have to do it again. If it happens to you, yeah.
Is it having the doubt that breaks wudu? Because what if you have a doubt and you think back and you remember, oh, actually, I have wudu.
Well, no, I mean then that wasn't really a doubt. If you have that doubt, because having the doubt outside of the prayer implies you have time to then think about it and you're unsure. That's why they specify outside of the prayer. So if you're outside of the prayer, you suddenly think, oh, well, am I in wudu? And then you think back and you just can't remember for sure whether you're in wudu or not. Then that breaks your wudu, being not sure. If you're in the prayer and you suddenly can't remember whether you did wudu or not, then you break your prayer and go and do, because not remembering whether you have done wudu or not is stronger than not remembering whether you've broken it or not. So in the prayer, then, if you remember that you're in wudu, you thought you were in wudu, you can remember doing wudu, but you don't know whether you broke it or not after doing wudu, then you remain in your prayer, finish it, then you reflect back on it. And if you still have doubt, then you should go and do wudu afterwards and make up the prayer. But you don't break your prayer. The other time when there is doubt is if you are in the prayer and suddenly you have a waswas of, or not a waswas, something you feel like you need to pass wind, for example, and you're in the prayer, and then suddenly something happens, like a feeling, but you're not sure if that was passing wind or simply, some sort of tremor that passes over your body, whatever it is. In that circumstance, you don't leave the prayer. Unless, as the Messenger of Allah sallallahu alaihi wasallam famously said, you heard something or you smelled something. If you heard something or smelled something of passing wind, then you leave the prayer, go and do wudu and come back. If you didn't, then you just ignore it and you continue with your prayer, unless afterwards it becomes clear to you that you did, in which case you better leave the prayer because you're not in wudu. So those are the various different types of doubt. There's also somebody, by the way, who has these doubts a lot. So some people, every time they go into the prayer, suddenly they go, "Oh no, did I break my wudu or not? Did I do wudu or not?" Happens almost every prayer or every day. Those people, they just ignore such doubts. Then you might have a person basically who has amnesia. They can't remember these things. Those people should obviously do wudu for every prayer. If you haven't got a memory that can last long enough to, then you better err on the side of doing wudu for every prayer if you're like that. There are things that you might assume break wudu before we go on to the things that actually do. Some people think these things break wudu, but they don't. The first is deliberately taking away your intention, consciously negating your wudu. If you do wudu and then you consciously say, "Nope, I'm not in wudu, I am making the intention that I'm out of wudu," that intention means nothing. It's a physical action that puts you in a state, and that's enough. You can't just remove that state by means of an intention. It's not the same as making a conscious decision to leave the deen, for example, but that does impact that. This doesn't. Or making an intention to do something that breaks your wudu. So saying, "I'm going to go to the toilet, I'm off to go to the loo," and then, then changing your mind and coming back and praying. The fact that you made a strong intention to go to the toilet doesn't break your wudu. These are other ones. So we're going to come on to one which is ex related to touching and pleasure and things like that. If somebody looks at something or thinks about, daydreams about something that they feel sexual pleasure as a result of doing that, even for a man, if that leads to an erection, that does not break your wudu. That alone itself does not break your wudu. Okay? It has to be a, unless something comes out as a result of that. Secondly, for people who are, wrong in the head, certain people are attracted to very young children, for example. If they touch a child that's too young for anybody to really to anybody who's sane to have enjoyment of, so long as they haven't touched that child in the privates, that doesn't break wudu, even if they experience pleasure. So it talks about even those types of people who are wrong in the head, who have sort of desires that are a result of fisq, deviance, but that doesn't break wudu. Unless they touch the private parts of those children with that intention. Similarly, if you are washing a child, if you have children and you wash them and touch them in the private parts when you're washing them after the toilet, That does not break your wudu. Next, things that come out, of the body that are not accompanied by feces, such as, for example, if you swallow a stone and that smoke stone passes through your body and comes out of your anus, that doesn't break your wudu if there's no feces attached to it. Similarly, if you have worms and worms come out, that does not break your wudu. And or even if you have blood that comes out there, you like people who have what's that thing that people have, like those stones in the kidney, in the, well,
these ones.
no, there's some other thing that people sometimes have that leads them to bleed,
Emirates.
hemorrhoids and things like that. Yeah, that does not break your wudu. We're going to go on to salas later, so we won't talk about that now. Bleeding from wounds. I've been asked this a few times by people. They said if they get cut and blood comes out, does that break your wudu? Nope, it doesn't. Throwing up. Throwing up does not break your wudu. Nope. In the prayer, yes, or fasting, yes. I don't know about other madhabs, but it does have an effect with when you're fasting, yes.
Fasting, yeah.
But not when it doesn't break wudu. Because the general rule here is that only things that come out of the two waste parts of the body, which are the anus and the penis, or the anus and the vagina for women, that's the only things that break wudu, not for anything that comes out anywhere else. And the other side of it is anything that comes into the body doesn't break wudu. It's what comes out. The Messenger of Allah sallallahu alaihi wasallam said, wudu is caused by what comes out, not what goes in. So, for example, somebody, sometimes will have an anal drip where they will insert some sort of nutrients in through that through there. That will not break wudu. And also, some people, I think it might be the Shafi'i madhab, think that eating certain meats, especially camel meat, I think.
Yeah, as for Shafi, eating
Big,
camel
big.
meat will nullify the wudu.
Yes, because the Messenger of Allah, so I think early on, had there was a position that even eating cooked foods, because of what it does to the body, in a sense, leads to wudu being broken. But that was not the case at the end of the Messenger of Allah's message. So Imam Malik said, anything that's been cooked, no meat, no anything, breaks wudu. And finally, there are other things that, there are hadith that indicate that they're very bad and they have a negative effect on the state of the human being, such as ghibah, speaking badly about people behind their back, namima, spreading tales, tall tales, or even things like laughing raucously out loud, which sort of sometimes loosens your control of your body somewhat when you do that. All of those things, lying, none of those things break wudu. Even though they will break your prayer, laughing, for example.
Yeah, nothing during the prayer.
Yeah. And all of these things, there are people who often ask questions about whether these things break wudu. None of these things do. The things that break wudu are limited here. He says, Al-wudu'u yajibu lima yakhruju min ahadil makhrajain. Wudu is obligatory for what comes out of one of the two makhraj, places of exit, the places where waste comes out of the body. Min bowlin. So he gives a list of them now. So firstly, what's called bowl in Arabic, which is urine. Don't need to explain it. It's well known what urine is. Or gha'it. Gha'it again is known. It's what we would call poo or feces, what comes out of the anus, whether it's solid or loose, all has the same ruling. Or rihin, or wind, again, specifically when it comes out of the back, but sometimes it can come out of the front as well, as with women more often than with men. I mean, that's not considered. So there's a difference of opinion about it when it comes out of the front. When it comes out of the back, it's always breaks. Although, awli ma yakhruju min al-dhakar, or the other types of fluid or liquids or discharges that come out of the penis, min madhi. Madhi is What accompanies sometimes for some people when they get sexually excited and get an erection, it's called pre-seminal fluid usually, and that is a sort of a very light liquid that comes out when they are sexually excited, but before they have semen seminal fluid come out. So when you have this muddy, this first one, muddy, when somebody gets sexually excited, this was some people, would get this quite a lot, especially, in societies where they were very vigorous societies. People ate maybe a lot of meat and things like that, very hot countries. I mean, Sidna Ali, radiallahu anhu, was famous for having this happen to him a lot. This particular substance that comes out requires you to also wash the entirety of the penis as well as do wudu from it. So that's madhi.
That doesn't make ghusl obligatory.
No, it doesn't. He says here, he describes what it is. Huwa ma'un abyad. It is a white or a clear liquid that is raqiq, that is thin, white, thin liquid, a white, clear, white here meaning clear, a clear, thin liquid. Yakhruju inda ladhati. It comes out when a person experiences sexual pleasure. Bil-in'aad, when there is an erection. Indal mula'aba, when he engages in play with his wife, for example. Oh, tithkar, or when somebody thinks on sexual matters or thinks on things that he finds sexually attractive. Wa'ammal wadiyu. So there's another one now. So we have urine. Then we have pre-seminal fluid, which is this light, thin liquid that comes out when you are sexually excited. Then we have wadyu. And this is a liquid that looks very similar to semen. It's a thick liquid that looks very, very similar to semen. He says here, wadyu is ma'un abiyad khathir. It is white fluid, white discharge that is thick. Yakhruju bi ithril bowl, that comes out immediately after urinating, especially in cold, when it's cold. So a person urinates, and then at the end of this urinate, there's a sort of thicker substance that comes out following the urine. So it's like post-urinary fluid. And that this substance looks a bit like semen, but has none of its scent or anything else. It's scentless, basically. This requires you to do wudu when it comes out. So even if it comes out without urinating, it requires you to do wudu, not ghusl. Yajibu minhu ma yajibu min al bowl. It is obligatory to do for this wadyu what you would do for bowl. And there's one other one that he doesn't mention here, which is mentioned in some of the books of fiqh, which is called hadi. Hadi, which is something for women, which is when a pregnant woman, her waters start to break when she's going to give birth. Those waters, when they come out slowly, they may take a long time to come out. These waters may be coming out for quite a while. Are they enough that she has to do ghusl? Is it already considered the birth? No. But they are considered something which breaks her wudu. So with these waters coming out, she does have to do wudu for them. Wa'ammal mani. So he's going on to something that he's going to go into more detail later, but he simply is talking about all the things that come out. So it's logical to talk about one other thing that comes out of the dhakar, out of the penis. And he says, as for semen, fahuul ma'ud dafiq, it is the water that comes out in spurts, or the fluid that comes out in spurts. Alladhi yakhruju inda ladhatil kubra, that comes out when you feel the greater pleasure, as he calls it. In other words, when you have orgasm, basically, as a man, that particular water that comes out, fluid that comes out accompanying that, is what's called mani. And he says here, biljima, when a person is having intercourse, It's ra'iha. The smell of it is like the ra'iha to tala, is like the smell of early dates before they, when they are in their early stage, they have a particular scent shortly after they've been flowers, and then they've turned into these beginning dates. They have a scent that's very similar to semen, or semen is very similar to it, as he's saying here. وَمَاءُ الْمَرْأَةِ مَاءٌ رَقِيقٌ. As for the mani, what's called the semen here, for want of a better word, of a woman, because it's considered that both men and women can have this mani, but the way it looks and the way it smells is different for each of them. She says when it's the waters or the fluid, the discharge of a woman in as a result of sexual orgasm, he says here it's ma'un raqiqun asfar. It is a yellowish, thin liquid, and it's the same ruling. Yajibu minhu at-tahr. Ghusl is obligatory for when that comes out. Okay. فَيَجِبُ مِنْ هَذَا تُهْرُ جَمِيعِ الْجَسَدِ. So this is what he's going to talk about later. But he says here, by this tuhr, because we literally means purification, he says here, by this we mean that they have to purify the entire body in the same way that it is obligatory to purify the entire body from haidah, from menstrual bleeding. So we'll come to that later as well. وَأَمَّا دَمُّ الْإِسْتِحَاضَةِ. So the reason he mentioned this haidah here is because he wants to go on to istihada. So haidah is menstrual blood, a woman's period, as we call it. But sometimes for women, they bleed down there when it is outside of their menstrual periods. And it's usually because of some, as a result of something that's cut inside, or some condition that they've got at the time, or whatever it is, some illness. So this is called damul istihaba, which they call false menstruation, false menstrual bleeding. And we're going to come into the rulings of this later, but false menstrual bleeding is not considered in the same way as menstrual bleeding. You do not have to do ghusl from it. You simply have to do wudu when that blood comes out. And even if it's continuing to come out, you pray. It doesn't make you impure so long as you've done wudu for it. That's if it's at the level of continuously coming out. Obviously, if it comes out sometimes, it doesn't come out other times, you time your prayers when it's not coming out. As for damul istihada, which is false menstrual bleeding, fayajibu minhu wudu. Wudu is obligatory from it. Wayustahabbu laha walisalisil bawl. It is recommended for her and for salasil bawl, the one who is incontinent in terms of urine, and yatawadda li kulli salah. So this is an important one as well. But it's recommended when you have what's called salas to do wudu for every prayer. But there are different degrees of salas. Salas is basically something coming out of your body without you being able to stop it coming out of your body. Uncontrolled leakage. And this could happen with urine. It often happens with urine with people when they get older. They can no longer stop urine dripping out of themselves. But it can also happen with madi, as we mentioned before. This was a condition sometimes people had that they couldn't stop this pre-seminal fluid coming out almost all the time. Very red-blooded person. And sometimes, it can even happen when people are, have eaten something really bad and they can't stop. Feces coming out all of the time. They need to go to the toilet constantly. Or if you've eaten something bad, for example, and it's led to you having very bad wind, so you can't stop yourself from farting all the time. All of these things are considered to be salas. And it depends how often it happens. By the way, we're going to talk first. The first one is when it happens all the time. That means all throughout all of the prayer times. Then it's not even recommended to do wudu for that thing. What he's talking about here is when it happens most of the time. That's when it's recommended that you do wudu for every prayer. When it's happening constantly, it's not even recommended. It's not considered to have any effect on you. Yes, if you have salas of urine, you're incontinent with urine and you go to the toilet and poo, that's obviously going to break your wudu. But the urine coming out has no effect in that particular context. And by all the time, we don't mean that every single second of every single moment of every single day is dripping out. We mean that by the time you've done wudu and pray and finished that prayer, it's come out again. That's what we mean. So maybe that's 5 minutes, 10 minutes. Every 5, 10 minutes is coming out. That's enough to mean all the time. If you can't even complete a prayer without it coming out again. I mean, I've known people who've had this with various different types of things. I mean, somebody who, had a really bad stomach once, and he couldn't complete a prayer without wind passing wind. So that meant that basically he's constant in it. So wind would not break his prayer in that context.
Or is it always?
Or his wudu. Well, yajibul wudu. So these are the first ones, which are called ahdath, things that break wudu in themselves. The second, wa yajibul wudu min zawalil aqli. The second, the major type of sabab, there's two types of sabab here, cause. There's the experiencing of sexual pleasure one, and there's the you're losing your ability, your intellect, basically, your mind being covered over, so you're no longer aware. This is called zawal al-aql, the intellect going, the aql disappearing. There's different number of ways this can happen. No, he says here, bi nawmin mustathqil. The first is by a deep sleep. A deep sleep is one, for example, if you're sitting and you fall asleep and somebody calls your name and you're not even aware that your name is being called, or saliva drips out of your mouth, or you're not even aware that your saliva is dripping from your mouth, or you're holding something and you drop it and you're not aware that you've dropped it, or your hand drops and you're not aware of that. That's deep sleep. That's deep sleep. If somebody calls your name and you're immediately shocked into a position where you're awake, in other words, your consciousness is half there, such that if somebody could call you or something, or your book in your hand suddenly drops, you're immediately aware it's dropped, then that's not deep sleep. So deep sleep breaks your wudu because you're completely unaware of what happens. Doesn't matter whether it is 30 seconds or 30 hours, it breaks your wudu. As for light sleep, when you're aware of what's happening, if that is for quite some time, you say let's say 20 minutes or whatever it is, or half an hour, or quite a decent length of time, then that's enough to make it recommended for you to do wudu, but it doesn't break your wudu. If it's only for a short time, like some people often do after the adhan of Fajr, they'll do their 2 rak'ats and they'll sort of sit on lie on their sides like some of the companions used to do, and they just sort of like semi-doze without falling asleep. That does not break anything. That doesn't even recommend you to do anything. That has no effect. So that's sleep. The second one here is ighma, which is losing consciousness through fainting, basically. When like the blood rushes to your head and you suddenly lose consciousness and you're unaware what happens, that immediately breaks your wudu. Or even a coma, which is a long stage of these. Where you're completely, your mind is completely absent, it's completely covered over. That breaks your wudu. The third one he mentions is sukr, which is being drunk, completely drunk, where you're unaware of what happens, basically. Even if the thing that made you drunk was accidentally drunk, or was something that you are allowed to drink and you didn't realize that it had come into an alcoholic form. Such as sometimes maybe milk becomes alcoholic, or some dates that you put aside and had in water for you to have, and you left them a bit too long without being aware, or whatever it is. Doesn't matter. If you are drunk and your brain is covered over, is clouded over as a result, that breaks your wudu. Again, all of these things, you're unaware of what you're doing when you're in that state. Oh, tachabbuti junoon. The final one is bouts of madness, bouts of insanity, maybe even sort of epileptic fits, for example, and things like that, where somebody not, I mean, I don't quite know exactly how an epileptic fit works, but there are certain types of fits where somebody loses themselves for a moment and then they come back to sanity. That thing where somebody loses themselves for a moment is enough to break your wudu. Or a long-term somebody, just goes completely insane for a bit, and then Allah restores their intellect to them. That has the same effect, and they're not held accountable for what they do while they're in that state. Whereas if somebody brings it upon themselves or is asleep, they are held accountable. So, in two of these, like a coma, or a madness, you do not have to make up what happens to you in that state. If you're asleep, then you do have to make up what happens to you when you're asleep. And if you are drunk, you have to make up what happens to you when you were drunk. ويجب الوضوء من الملامسة للذة والمباشرة. So he says here, wudu is made obligatory from mulamasa lilladha, from touching somebody. Usually the word lamps refers to touching something deliberately with the hand, or actually consciously touching something with the hand. It doesn't always have to be conscious, though, as we're going to see in this case, because even if it's done accidentally and you experience pleasure, that's enough. So if you touch a woman who is of the, who is old enough, because we mentioned earlier, if they're extremely young, this doesn't count. But if a woman is old enough that a person might normally be expected to derive pleasure from the touching of her, or a woman touches a man that she might be expected to derive the pleasure of touching, then if they intend pleasure by doing that touch, whether it's through clothes or directly on flesh, or they experience pleasure without intending it, or both happens, that's enough to break your wudu. If you touch her without any intention and without any experience of pleasure, then that does nothing to you. And then that's one part. The other part here is mubashara bil jasad lilladhi. Or if any part of your body touches any part of her body and you experience pleasure as a result of that, whether it's through clothing or directly, then again, the same thing. Whether it's with the hand or whether it's any part of your body. If there is an intention or an experience of pleasure, your wudu is broken. If neither happens, then it's not. The Shafi'is go to even further than that. They say that any touching of anybody of the opposite sex breaks your wudu. I don't know if they exempt your mother and your sister and things like that, but their general position is that. By the way, this includes for those people who, again, are deviant. If they experience pleasure from touching their mother or their sister, that also breaks their wudu. Or they intend it. Wal qubla lilladha. And making a kiss for the purpose of pleasure. Whether you're wherever you kiss a person, if you touch them with your hands, you touch them with your body, you touch them with your lips, it's all the same. Except it's a bit stronger with the kiss. Because a kiss, if you kiss on the lips, even if your intention was not for pleasure, and your intention was not, well, and you didn't experience pleasure, there are circumstances where that will still break your wudu. You're allowed to do it as a way of saying goodbye. For example, somebody might say goodbye to their wife when they go, and they leave the house, or as a rahmah for children, for example. You know, common amongst the Arabs was parents would kiss even their children on the lips as part of their sort of just general way of showing rahmah or mercy or compassion to them. But if you kiss your wife out of affection, not to say goodbye, just because you're being affectionate, but not wanting sexual pleasure, just out of affection, that breaks your wudu. That's the Maliki position on this. So you're only allowed to do it to say goodbye, for example, or out of compassion, but not for the wanting to show a sign of affection between to your wife, for example.
For your kids as well, you have to make wudu.
No. As I said, well, it depends. You see, if you kiss somebody who is your child, and she is old enough that a deviant might experience pleasure, then that's enough. The experiencing of pleasure is enough to break your rule. So, I mean, depends on it. Not for young children, obviously. Wamin massi dhakar, and the touching of the penis. So this is referring to men, obviously, not to women. Although he talks about the women after this. If a man above the age of puberty touches his penis directly, with the inside of his palm, the inside of his fingers, the side of his fingers, or the sides of his palm, then, regardless of whether he did it accidentally or intentionally, experienced pleasure, didn't experience pleasure, whatever it is, that breaks your wudu. So you have to be very careful when you're doing ghusl. That when you're doing ghusl, you don't, after you've done the wudu part of the ghusl, you don't touch your penis after that, because that will break your wudu portion of your ghusl. This is based on the hadith of the Messenger of Allah sallallahu alaihi wasallam, who said if somebody touches their penis, they have to do wudu. This is when you touch it directly, not through a cloth. So if you touch your penis through a cloth, or touch it with the back of your hand or any other part of your body, even if you experience pleasure by that, that doesn't break your wudu. It's only touching it with the palm or the fingers or the insides of the fingers that do. As for women touching their private parts, their vagina, that is a matter of a difference of opinion. The strongest position, the one that Ibn Ashir mentioned, for those who are with Ibn Ashir, is that does not break the wudu of a woman. It only breaks it if she inserts any of her fingers into her vagina, which is the only thing that breaks wudu for her in that respect. Well, yajibut tuhru. So this is that's what that's that, is there any questions? That's basically the things that break wudu. That's all of them. Are there any questions about that? No. Well, yajibut tuhru mimma dhakarna, and tuhur, which again means purification, but here is how he's describing ghusl, is obligatory from what we mentioned before. And if you remember when we were talking about the ahdath of wudu, the things that break wudu, we mentioned many semen. So he said we mentioned it before, but he's going back into it again because we're now talking about what makes ghusl obligatory. He says here, so it is made obligatory by the things we mentioned before, and they are khurujul ma' al-dafiq lil-ladha, the emergence of spurting fluid, in other words, semen, lil-ladha, for pleasure. So this condition he adds here, lil-ladha, and they also add mu'tada elsewhere, for expected ordinary types of pleasure, is he's added it here for a reason, because there are circumstances where many coming out, semen coming out, do not break a person's ghusl. For example, if somebody is stung by a scorpion, or sharp pain can sometimes have the effect of causing semen to come out of the body, or some people can suffer from salus of semen, where especially when they get older and have prostate problems, semen can come out of their body without any pleasure. It's just one of the things that emerges from the body, so that can happen. So that's without pleasure at all. Sometimes it can happen with the accompaniment of pleasure, but not in the normal way of enjoying oneself with a woman or whatever it is. So they give the examples of a scorpion stinging you, or getting into a hot bath, or riding a horse that's jiggling around a lot, or any of these types of things where you wouldn't normally expect pleasure. If you're experiencing pleasure and you can stop it, in other words, you feel the start of something happening, then you have to stop. If you allow yourself to continue, then you are culpable. But if it's something that you have no control over, suddenly you feel this pleasure and suddenly it all happens, then that has no effect on you, and you simply have to do wudu, no ghusl. As for when you're asleep, whether you experience pleasure or not is immaterial. The only condition is whether there's wetness there when you wake up or not. If there is, you have to do ghusl. Clear? So fi nawmin, whether when a person is asleep, or yaqadha, or when a person is awake, min rajulin aw imra'a. So this applies to both men and women. When semen comes out, regardless of how it comes out, or when the woman's discharge that accompanies sexual pleasure comes out, regardless of how it comes out, that breaks your ghusl. That means that requires you to do a ghusl. أو انقطاع دم الحيضة, or the coming to an end of menstrual bleeding. So he mentioned before that ghusl is made obligatory by menstrual bleeding. Here he's talking about the second part of that. You can't, have your ghusl while you're still bleeding menstrually. It doesn't make any sense. You have to wait for that menstrual bleeding to stop before you then do your ghusl. So it has to have stopped before the ghusl becomes, that's the precondition for it being acceptable. So a menstrual bleeding is, well, most women recognize, and this is a thing that women know about their own bodies. It happens in different ways for different women. It comes out in different amounts for different women. Its color is different for different women. There's all these various different factors. I mean, in order for a woman to know more about it, it's best for her to ask other women who know, basically. But there are fiqh positions with regard to this. If it comes out just once, that's and then stops, you have to do. So there's two ways of looking at the menstrual period. There's a menstrual period when it comes to iddah, and the menstrual period when it comes to prayer, or not fasting. The menstrual period when it comes to iddah, you add up all of the days, even if there's big gaps between the days of bleeding. The menstrual period when you come to the prayer, if it stops bleeding for long enough to you to do a prayer, then you have to do a for you to do a ghusl and a prayer within a prayer time. You do a ghusl and you pray, even if you're still in your what's known as your period. You don't keep you don't say, well, I know it's going to come again later on in the day. As soon as it stops, you do ghusl and you pray. And if it starts again. Then you do. And then if it stops again, you do ghusl and pray. So it's not exactly the same as it is for the iddah. Even if you are in your period, there may still be times when you are required to pray. Istihadha. So he mentions istihadha here when it comes to ghusl because it's recommended to do a ghusl when you have false menstrual bleeding, but it's not obligatory. So if you have a period of false menstrual bleeding outside of your normal menstrual period, and then that stops, it's recommended for you to do a ghusl to make yourself clean, but it hasn't broken your greater state of purity, so you're not required to do it. It's simply a recommendation. Aw an-nifas. So nifas is what's known as postnatal bleeding. So again, when a woman gives birth, often after birth, this is accompanied by a period of bleeding. Sometimes this lasts a very short time, just a little bit of blood that accompanies the birth, and that's it. Sometimes it goes on and on and on and on and on. This blood is not, strictly speaking, a menstrual blood. It's got nothing to do with cleaning out the womb in the same, it's for it to be prepared again in the same way. It's accompanying the birth. So they call it postnatal bleeding. Or lochia, I think, is another term that they use for this. And again, that's something that requires ghusl. Then the final, so there's four things that require ghusl. There's ejaculation of semen. There is that applies to men and women. Then there is hayd, which is menstrual bleeding, which is only to do with women. Then there is nifas, which is postnatal bleeding, which is only to do with women. And then there is maghibul hashafa fil farj, so penetration of the penis into for one, the farj here is he uses this word. It's not just the vagina, but it's the act of intercourse, whether it's in the vagina or in the anus, whether it's with a man or a woman. whether it's with a human being or an animal, whether it's with somebody who's alive or somebody or something that's dead. All of these things break. Also, whether the penis in question is in a state of erection or is flaccid, all the th so long as the head of the penis goes into the farj, the hole here, that is enough to cause ghusl. For the person who does it and for the person to whom it's done, for both. Although there are exceptions to this. So if if children do it with each other, even prepubescent children, very close to puberty, but not at puberty yet, that does not require a ghusl. If the one who does it to is a child and does it to a woman who's an adult, neither person has to do ghusl then either. But if and if the if it's a, if it's an adult man who does it with a child, the adult man has to do it. He has to do ghusl regardless of what he does it with. If an adult man inserts his penis into anything of this nature, he has to do ghusl regardless. But for a woman, it's not exactly so clear cut. So here he says here, wa in lam yanzil, even if he does not ejaculate or even if he's not erect, it's enough for a whistle to be required. Wa maghibul hafasha, so now he repeats this again because he wants to say this act here of intercourse has other consequences, not just ghusl. So he wants to list them. He says, "Maghibul hashafa," the insertion of the head of the penis into the vagina here, or not the vagina if it's the anus. Yujibul ghusl. Firstly, the first thing that it makes obligatory is ghusl. Wa yujibul had. The second thing it makes obligatory on a person is the had punishment. So if a man does this with somebody who is not his wife, then the had punishment is on both those people if they are both willing participants. If he does it with a man, then the had punishment for sodomy is on both participants if both participants are willing participants in this. If he does it with, if he has intercourse with his wife from behind in the anus, that also has consequences, what's called ta'dib, which is disciplinary punishment. Obviously, for all of these had punishments, though, and all of these punishments, they can only happen if there are witnesses, or if somebody makes a confession, or in the case of proper intercourse, pregnancy. So those there has to be cons you know there those are the only times when a had punishment could actually take place. A qadi cannot give somebody a had punishment if there are, for example, three witnesses to adultery. It needs four witnesses to the act. And those three witnesses, if they come forward, even if they saw it, they are given the had punishment themselves of false testimony, of speaking against somebody's name, because they have spoken out against somebody's ird, somebody's sort of reputation. So, I mean, you have to, it's not an easy, these had punishments don't happen very easily. That's the reality to it. We're going to come into more of that. But I mean, for example, pregnancy is one. So that's an issue. So if a woman, for example, is raped, then basically she needs to let people know, at least in her family or others, that if that happens very soon. Because otherwise, then if she suddenly becomes pregnant later, this is obviously in a society where these things are. Where these punishments are carried out, which probably doesn't exist in the world today. Maybe in one or two places, but they don't do it properly or fully. But I mean, in those cases, then people have to be informed in situations like that. But we're going to come across those types of had punishments in more detail when we come on that section, inshallah, later. Wa yujibu sadaq. So this sadaq is often translated as the dowry. But it's not limited to when somebody is married to somebody. So if a man has intercourse with somebody, and she is not a willing participant, for example, then he owes her the sadaq. even if they're not to be married. If they are marrying somebody, then the full dowry becomes obligatory the moment they consummate it by intercourse. So the sadaqah applies more than just in the situation of marriage. I mean, it's only when two partners, also, for example, if somebody, I don't know how often these situations happen, but if somebody by mistake sleeps with the wrong person, gets into the wrong bed, whatever it is, and the parties are not aware of this, then he owes the sadaqah to that person he slept with. So there are various situations of that sort where sadaqah outside of marriage, the dowry, for want of a better word. And it was a known thing for some, for women of a particular background, they would have their known sadaqah. Well, yuhsinu zawjain, and it makes both the man and the woman who are married, if they do this, it changes their status from being ghairu muhsan to muhsan. So why is that important? Like, this literally means protected. Have you any idea why this is important? Because if somebody is not muhsan, and they become muhsan not just for that, then even if they get divorced and marry somebody else, they're still muhsan. Whenever a man and a wife have intercourse together for the first time, a man and a woman has intercourse in marriage for the first time, they become muhsan. What this does is it changes their had punishment. So before a person is muhsan, they're considered to be guilty of fornication. So you get your punishment for that would be the whip, 80 whips, 80 lashes. After you've become muhsan, if you commit adultery, then your punishment is death. So it changes the had punishment. So it changes your status as a person, this act of intercourse, when you do it for the first time in marriage. You're no longer the same type of person that you were before you did it. Changes your had punishment. Even if the person that you are fornicating with is themselves not married, and you've divorced and you're no longer married. If you fornicate with somebody and you have been married before in a consummated marriage, you are muhsan. Wa And it makes halal the woman who has been divorced three times for the one who divorced her. Obviously, this means that a woman who was married to somebody and then they got divorced three times and then she remarries, that act of remarriage is not alone to make it halal for her to then, if she divorces this one she's married, to go back and marry that one again. No. The only thing that makes her lawful for the one who divorced her three times is if she marries somebody else. They consummate the marriage, they have intercourse, and then that second husband divorces her, then she completes her iddah, then the original husband can marry her again. Otherwise, no. So that's what it means here. Well, yufsid al-hajj, and it makes your hajj invalid. If you have intercourse while you are in ihram for hajj, it's not one of the things you can make right by a sacrifice. The moment you have intercourse, whoever you have intercourse with, but obviously it's more likely that you're having intercourse with your wife because you've gone on Hajj with your wife. The moment that happens, your Hajj is invalid and you have to come back and make it up in another year. You can't just do a sacrifice and make it right. Obviously, a lot of people do Hajj now by tamattu in the modern era, which means that they actually go to do Umrah, then they leave the ihram from Umrah, then they spend a few days in Mecca, then they go back into ihram for Hajj. If you have intercourse in those periods of time when you're not in ihram, then that's fine. That's not considered to be while you're on Hajj. Because you've simply completed an Umrah, then you're waiting in Hajj until you decide to go, you're waiting in Mecca until you decide to go into ihram for Hajj. That's not what we mean on Hajj. It's when you're in ihram for Hajj. Finally, well, yufsid as-sawm. So this will be the last bit we finish today. The final thing here is it makes your sawm invalid. So if you're fasting and you forget you're fasting and you go and have intercourse with your wife, your fasting is invalid regardless of whether it's an obligatory fast whether it's a Soma Tatawa, it's a voluntary fast. Because with eating, if you're doing a voluntary fast and you accidentally eat, that doesn't break your voluntary fast. Whereas if you accidentally eat in Ramadan, according to Malik, that does break your fast. But with intercourse, it breaks your fast, whatever the type of fast is. And if you do it deliberately in Ramadan, there's some pretty serious consequences. But for Malik, there's serious consequences even if you deliberately eat in Ramadan. You have to do the kafara. But we'll come on to that when we come on to some. So, are there any questions on any of this? I think we pretty much reached this, although there's going to be a bit more description of menstruation, exactly how it works. But actually, that's slightly more complicated than people realize. So, I mean, obviously, we're already an hour in, so I'm not going to go into that. We'll go into that. We'll go through that quite quickly. Although, there are any questions about that, then we'll go into those next time because half the population has that issue that they have to deal with. Okay. Well, we'll finish. Yes.
Motor.
Yeah.
When you're a dog, thank you.
Dog.
Dog, yeah. You have to take care
You
of.
mean when you're fasting?
No. Just dog. When come close to you and lick you, you have to
Oh,
take.
dogs. No,
Yeah.
no. It doesn't do anything to you.
You don't have to take shower or.
It's an act of worship, which is shown by the fact that there's a specific number attached for you to wash yourself. It doesn't break wudu. Doesn't break wudu, but it is an act of ibadah for you to wash yourself seven times, wash the place seven times with a dog lick, yes. But it's not something that's considered to be put impurity on you. If it was impurity, then as we know from cleaning ourselves after the toilet, you keep on cleaning yourself until you're clean, even if that's one time or if it's 50 times, you just keep on cleaning yourself until you're clean. The proof that the dog's lick is not impure is the fact that it's limited to a set number of times. You do it seven times, regardless of whether the first time was washed everything off or not. Or regardless of if something's left after seven times, you just do it seven times. So we don't consider that to be impure. That's physical impurity. It certainly doesn't have any effect on wudu, a dog licking you.
I heard that you see Duncan said it's only if it's a very dirty kind of dog and it licks you, is that it's classed as being something you need to clean seven times.
Well, it actually, even then, doesn't. It depends on if you can see impurity in. I'm talking about whether there is impurity, but it's seven times regardless. The general position is if you're licked by a dog, it's seven times whatever type of dog, as far as I understand. But if it's actually impure, you have to be able to see impurity in the saliva of the dog on you. For example, maybe it's just licked some poop and then come and licked you. And you see the bits of, or smell the poop on you, then obviously that's some impurity you have to remove. Otherwise, it's not.
The impurity being on you doesn't break into.
No, but it would be something that you shouldn't have on you when you're praying. We're going to come to that afterwards, inshallah. All right, any other questions?
We had 7 times. You have to make wudu 7 times. He was.
No, it's not wudu. It's not wudu. When a dog does not remove your wudu, it's simply an act of ibadah to wash the place that the dog licked seven times.
7 times.
Yeah.
I just wash it
Yeah.
like.
Okay, we'll finish there, inshallah. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Ar-Rahman Ar-Rahim. Maliki Yawmiddin. Iyyaka na'budu wa iyyaka nasta'in. Ihdina siratal mustaqim. Siratal ladhina an'amta alayhim. Ghayril maghdubi alayhim wa ladhdallin. Ameen. Allahumma salli ala sayyidina Muhammadin abdika wa rasulika an-nabiyyil ummi wa ala alihi wa sahbihi wa sallim taslima. Subhana rabbika rabbil izzati amma yasifun. Wa salamun al mursalin. Walhamdulillahi rabbil alameen. Assalamu alaikum.
Sure.